Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's going on, everyone? Welcome to another episode of Bro History. It's Henry Zamota and Danny of Deljabar. Danny, what's up, man? How are you?
Chilling, as per usual. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty good. I can't really complain. It is Sunday at 7:24 Eastern Standard Time. What time zone is Puerto Rico, by the way? I don't even know what they call it.
It's Eastern Time minus one? It's called... No, it's plus one, actually. It's called plus Atlantic one, Time Zone. But Puerto Rico doesn't observe daylight savings time. So for this half of the year, I'm an hour ahead of you. But the next half of the year, I'll be at the same time zone as you.
So what is the status of Puerto Rico right now? Are you enjoying it? Do you like it? Do you miss
New York? Actually, it's been fun. And just to provide a quick update to you guys, because I know you're all so interested in my expedition or my crusade against IKEA. Apparently, I think IKEA listens to the show, because within about 3 hours of releasing the episode last time, where I bitched for about 5 minutes about not getting a couch, somebody from the IKEA Puerto Rico reached out, and it was actually a person that could help, finally. And by the next day, I got a couch. I got my couch. All the random, it's on a truck, it's in a fucking boat, it's, in Sweden, all the random shit they were all saying was bullshit, and they were able to get me the couch. So thank you, or, I guess, I don't know.
It seems like the supply chain bottlenecks have unbottled.
Yeah, they've unbottled in the neck.
They unbottled in the neck, so we're able to get you your couch.
Well, I appreciate that. It's great to have a platform where it can actually make change in the world, freeing Britney and getting an IKEA couch. Hit us up. Tell us what you want us to do for you. Apparently it works on our show.
If we say it, it will happen. Or if we complain about it will maybe happen. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about update on, I guess today we're going to talk about Russia, Ukraine. It's going to be more of a current events show. Next week, we're going to continue our Korean War series. We're going to start with, last week we did the creation of the Joseon Dynasty and all of that, and the foundations of Korean history that led to the war. Next week, we're going to do Japanese occupation and an actual lead up to the Korean War and World War II and all that stuff. But today, we're going to talk about Russia and Ukraine mostly. I think we'll talk about some other stuff as well if we get to it.
Yeah.
And so, we've talked about this a bunch. If you want full background on the current crisis, we have a lot of episodes that we discussed it on. But right now, in this current chapter of U.S. relations with Russia that's going on, the more I believe this just to be a giant piece of political theater. So there's this newsletter I subscribe to by a Russia watcher named Gilbert Doctorow, and he's based out of Brussels. He's a pretty sober-minded guy, and what he's been saying is that the current hype about the war is really just meant to provide cover to discuss things which without a crisis would not be possible to talk about. So in other words, the talk of war is allowing the Biden administration to consider Russia's demands for revising the security architecture in Europe.
Okay.
You may say this. You may say, well, the U.S. already said no to Russian demands about not allowing Ukraine to join NATO, which they, in other words, they did basically say no, or at least the Biden administration sent back their written response to Russia. We don't know exactly what it said, but we can kind of assume that will not be on the table to have a hard line saying that Ukraine will not join NATO like the Russians want them to.
Well, they published in last September on the White House that they support Ukraine's a freedom to choose their own like political, geopolitical, and foreign policy. So, you know,
they're basically saying no. they're basically saying no, but we're going to allow them to apply to join NATO. Right. But the reality is that they're not going to be eligible to join NATO. They have too many border disputes. They don't meet the criteria. They don't really add anything to NATO. I mean, there's a lot of countries in NATO that don't really add anything. Like, what does Bulgaria add to NATO? You know, what does North Macedonia add to NATO? You know, there's a lot of countries that don't really add much to NATO in terms of a military alliance. Like, what does Estonia add to NATO other than just being a big, like, piece of chunk of land that's closer to the motherland of Russia?
I'd argue all of those things for all of those other countries. That kind of
makes sense. Like, some NATO countries might post-Cold War make a little bit of sense. Like, Poland makes sense to me in some ways. You know, in Central Europe, you know, Poland is a country that's, like, pretty easy just to walk into. That makes sense to me. But, you know, other countries don't make too much sense. But what I was saying before, you know, the U.S. said that they're not going to allow – the U.S. has already said no to Russian demands. But the Russians know that they're not going to get something in writing. They just want an understanding that nyet means nyet. And when I say nyet means nyet, that's the title of a memo by William Burns, the current CIA director right now. When he was ambassador to Russia, this was back in 2010, I think it was 2000 or 2008 actually, and they were discussing Ukraine's membership in NATO, and apparently Sergei Lavrov said "nyet" means "yet yet," or that was like the tone of the conversation. Like, that was a very hard line. There was a red line that couldn't be crossed. If Ukraine were to join NATO, then Russia would launch some type of invasion, or, you know, that was at least the impression that William Burns received to release a cable called "Nyet Means Nyet." You know, there's an understanding that Ukraine joining NATO crosses a very clear red line for Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So, last month, Putin made a speech to his generals about how these MK-41 missile launchers in Romania, another NATO country, that's a new NATO addition, were being deployed in Poland, you know, another newer NATO country, I guess, in the context of the Cold War. But, you know, these missile launchers can be used as Tomahawk strike missiles.
Right. So not just strictly defensive. And also, Romania had signaled a greater willingness to host more NATO troops. They're actually pretty pumped about it. They're like, bring more troops over. Let's do it.
If you look at, like, the troop contributions for NATO, I think Romania is up there in like the top five contributors of troops. I think they have around 200,000 troops or so. It's like the U.S. and Turkey are by far the highest. Like, the U.S. is number one, Turkey's number two, and then I think number Poland's three, four, and five. I don't know what the exact number is, but Romania is very high up there. Like, they're higher than Britain, than Great Britain.
Great Britain.
So, you know, there's that. There's these MK-41 missile launchers. And then, in addition, this year there's a plan to start construction of these two naval bases in Ukraine, in Berdansk, I think it's pronounced Berdansk,
Berdyansk,
and then Oshakov. And Berdyansk is to the east of Crimea, so it's in the Sea of Azov, and then Oshakov is only about 60 miles away from Crimea. It's to the west of Crimea, but only, it's very close. It's like right on the southern coast of Ukraine. And, you know, this is a new red line for Putin. And, you know, these bases are formally going to be Ukrainian, but in reality, the equipment and the personnel will almost entirely be American or British. So I think the Russians are trying to get enough leverage to remove all Western military infrastructure right now out of Eastern and Southern Ukraine. And right now, they seem to have a lot of ways to pressure the U.S. to get what they want. You know, they have the ability, I mean, let's just start with the obvious one. You know, they have the ability to nuke anywhere in Europe with medium-range missiles.
Right.
You know, they can just park some... I mean, they can just park some medium-range missiles in Belarus and, you know, be able to strike anywhere in Europe, right?
Yeah.
There's also talk about the Russians building bases and ports in Venezuela to, you know, I don't know if they're going to put missiles, but they're going to host, like, strategic bombers and you know, ports will have, like, submarine capabilities. And, you know, the gist is that, you know, these ports and these bases will give Russia the ability to strike the U.S. swiftly if anything goes down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how bad would it be? When I say leverage, I mean, how bad would it be for the Biden administration right now if there was a new version of the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yeah, I mean, I think we covered this on our last episode on Ukraine. It's totally within Venezuela's right to choose who they do foreign policy with. And I mentioned this earlier, but here's that quote that I was talking about before from the White House website, and it's called the Joint Statement on the U.S.-Ukraine Strategic Partnership, and this was from the past September, and it reads, "As the United States and allies reaffirm in the June 2021 NATO summit communique, the United States supports Ukraine's right to decide its own future foreign policy course free from outside interference, including with respects to Ukraine's aspirations to join NATO." So, you know, you want to fucking spin that on its head. Russia can argue the same for Venezuela joining forces with Russia. You know, it's, you know, you could just change the names, right? So it could be, you know, Russia affirms that Venezuela's right to decide its own future foreign policy course free from outside interference, including with respect to Venezuela joining Russia, right? It would be a real fuck you to the U.S. for supporting Ukraine, and they could totally do it.
You know, you just really start to imagine all the places that they can pop up. Like, imagine if Venezuela joined the Collective Security Treaty Organization. That's like the Russian-led version that includes, like, Armenia and Kazakhstan. You know, they recently just were deployed for the first time ever in Kazakhstan as, you know, as a security force to secure a lot of the Russian, like, military infrastructure and their space station. And, you know, they're really smart when you think, like, looking back, we did an episode on Kazakhstan 2 weeks ago. And, you know, they were really smart about it when they went in there because they didn't even actually confront the protesters. The only thing they did was they went to the airport. They went to the space station. They went to, like, Russian military areas. And they secured those areas. And what that did is that freed up the Kazakhstani security forces to go, you know, deal with the protesting, because the last thing you want is them to go inside and you know, shoot a protester, and that's all over the news, and then there's, like, you know, things reach a whole new level of crazy. But yeah, imagine if they joined that, you know, if Venezuela or something, a country in the Western Hemisphere joined, you know, some type of an alliance with that. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't even really know what the criteria is to join that, if that's just exclusively for Eurasian countries. But, you know, the point I'm trying to make is that, you know, they could, I mean, you can just imagine there's a lot of different ways for them to escalate things, and there's a lot of different tools that they could use. And they can really just, you know, poke out nuclear submarines off the coast of the United States just to say, hey, like, we're watching. You know, there was a report that there was a submarine in the Atlantic Ocean within, like, 100 miles of the eastern coastline.
That's right.
So, I mean, they're doing that. And I think Sputnik recorded that, or some Russian press recorded it. So it would be Russian media. It was Russian media who I saw. So, you know, imagine if that was, like, you know, that scare, like a Russian sub sighting, just to say, hey, we're here and we can strike a city if we need to, or if things escalate. Now, I'm not saying they're doing it. I'm just saying, like, that's just, you know, a geopolitical power play that they have the ability to play right now. And it's spooky. It's definitely spooky. Like, I certainly wouldn't be in favor of Russian nuclear missiles in Venezuela. Like, I wouldn't be in favor of that at all. As an American who lives in a major city, I would hate that. Like, I wouldn't like that. I imagine a lot of Americans would be troubled by that as well. So, you know, sort of like North Korea, you know, how North Korea has all these tests and, you know, they have this nuclear program. You know, I think North Korea has those programs to negotiate them away. And I think the Russians are kind of doing that as well. You know, there's different ways they can escalate, and you know they can use these things to negotiate these things away whenever, you know, when they're dealing with Washington. So if they're, you know, if they go to the negotiating table, you know, that can be something that they could bring to the table. Okay, well, we will not create a put a base in the Western Hemisphere if you make a guarantee, or you know, at least a verbal guarantee or whatever demands that they want, or remove these missiles from Ukraine. And Biden kind of said that already, like he was not going to, that those missiles weren't going to be there in Romania. So he said that kind of like passingly, like it wasn't like an official statement, but he had already said that. So it seems like, you know, there's a lot more, there's more cooperation than being let on by the media, you know, and you can probably guess a million reasons why. But it definitely seems like there's a little bit more cooperation. But, you know, what's going on right now is, like, these are psychological games, you know, to remove things that they don't like. And the problem is that in the U.S., if you negotiate with the Russians or if you give credence to their demands, the political system will attack you. And, you know, the political system as in, like, the corporate press and, you know, the combination of, like, the think tankers – you know, not necessarily that that would be an unpopular opinion or unpopular move across the average American, but special interest groups, arms lobbies, think tankers, corporate press journalists, they're going to go after you if you negotiate with the Russians. Just look at Germany right now, and we'll talk about that later. But I don't think most Americans care about this unless, you know, people are – you probably – you told me that you're kind of facing the same thing that I am right now. A lot of people are coming to you and asking you about Ukraine on a personal level, like your person, you know, your friends in real life. They're like, hey man, what's going on with Ukraine? Same things happened to me. You know, like a lot of people are like, what the hell is going on with Ukraine? Like, are we going to war with over to Russia or something? Like what?
Yeah.
And it's interesting to see that, but otherwise they most likely wouldn't really think about this.
Right. And not only that, but like it seems that Putin doesn't really care about sanctions that get levied against Russia. I mean, otherwise he would have thought twice about his actions in 2014. And I think the combination of it being politically dangerous in the West to negotiate with Russia and Russia not giving a shit about the consequences of doing something is in itself dangerous. You know, that's a shitty combination, you know?
Yeah. Well, there was a Washington Post poll back in 2014 that found that the less Americans know where Ukraine is located, the more likely they want the U.S. to intervene.
Yeah,
so
I can believe that.
The less you know about this, the current conflict, the more likely you'd be willing to go to war over it. Washington Post poll. So this was back in 2014. You know, I would imagine that it pretty much reflects the attitudes now. In that,
yeah, I think it's also fascinating that the less you know about Ukraine, the more you are apt to want to intervene. And I think that ignorance is just like, I feel like propaganda works best on the ignorant, right? And I don't mean to say that, like, you know, that people that don't know where Ukraine is are ignorant, like as a derogatory term. I just mean that you're ignorant to the fact that Ukraine is located in Eastern Europe next to Russia, you know, like it's just a fact, you know? So the less you know about the situation, the more propaganda works on you and the more that you're able to see, you know, or take in the information that is being fed to you by, you know, certain media outlets. And we'll definitely talk about that more later, but I just think that's a product of that.
Yeah, I mean, how many people could point Iraq or Afghanistan on a map in 2003 or 2001 and 2003?
I certainly couldn't.
Me neither. I certainly could not at all. I imagine most people don't. I imagine most Americans couldn't then, still can't now. And there's no shame in that. Like, I'm not trying to say that same thing. Like, you're not trying to say it in a derogatory way. I think in a lot of ways, you know, you don't really need to know.
You don't need
to
know
the map of the world on like the back of your hand, you know? I think you should know the map of your country probably more than the map of a foreign country
or something like that.
Or city, your city. Like, I don't really think there's a shame in that.
No.
But it's interesting to see that, you know, the less you know, the more likely you can kind of be tricked into supporting these warmongering attitudes. Mm-hmm. All right, so I want to talk about this. Would the U.S. even win a war? You know, let's just say if worse comes to worse. So something pops off. Let's just say there's an Archduke Ferdinand type moment where we sleepwalk into war with Russia and Ukraine, or NATO sleepwalks into Russia, you know, in Ukraine. Other than sanctions, I don't really know what leverage the U.S. really has over Russia right now. Russia has over 100,000 troops poised on three sides of Ukraine right now. And the deterrent that the U.S. has is like 8,500 U.S. troops now placed on high alert.
Right.
Like, is that really an effective deterrent? Think about the military mismatch right now in eastern Ukraine between NATO and Russian forces. First of all, Russia already has a military there. And NATO, on the other hand, it would take them, 6 to 9 months just to mobilize 30,000 troops?
Right. And I think it shows you how serious the West is about a conflict with Russia. They aren't. Otherwise, you'd see a much bigger buildup of forces on the West side, you know? I think the goal here is just to arm Ukrainians and just fight by proxy, fight Russia by proxy, that is. You know, there's some pretty big deals being cut right now to arm Ukrainians and stuff's moving on that front too. So all you really need to do is follow the money to see where the priorities lie. You know, that's all I have to say on that.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, I think it is kind of an Occam's razor type thing where you kind of just follow the policy of what's going on and you disband the rhetoric that's coming out of the press and politicians. And you just see like, all right, like the U.S., no one's really preparing for war. Like NATO forces aren't preparing for war. Like Germany and Estonia and Latvia and all these countries are not really nervous that Russia's going to come marching in there like a bunch of, like Attila the Hun or whatever. It's more about just like getting weapons deals and stuff like that and making money right now. And I have more to say about that because there was an interview with a lot of the CEOs of like major arms dealers like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon, where they basically said that in plain English, bluntly. But let me put a pin in that because I actually have notes on that. Now, there's still a lot of Russian analysts, though, or people who I follow and read all the time who are saying that, you know, there is a chance that the Russians could invade. One of them is being Colonel Douglas McGregor, who was Trump's guy who he brought in to end the war in Afghanistan. And you know it was kind of too late by the time he got him in there, but you can find this guy on Tucker Carlson all the time, and he's calling out the Pentagon and the MIC all the time, and I think he's a really smart guy, and I read him all the time. He seems to think that the Russians will, or at least he did maybe a week or two ago. I'm not sure if he still thinks they are. And then there's this other guy. His name is Clint Ehrlich. He was on Tucker Carlson about a week ago or so, and he basically kind of laid out the current conflict and very bluntly in plain English. And you know, he said that everything was happening because of NATO expansion, and you know, he kind of presented Russia's point of view. And this guy was called like a Russian asset and a Russian intelligence, and you know, this guy was slandered really bad. But, you know, I listened to an interview with him on Scott Horton, and he was basically making the case that Russia right now, the reasons why they would or could invade is because the window for them to make a military, like a move like this, is actually going to shrink because Ukraine, even though they have a weak military right now, eventually they're going to have the bases. Eventually they're going to have the military, the missile technology. Eventually that window is going to narrow for the Russians to, you know, make a move in Donbass or any of the territories in Ukraine that are currently, you know, autonomous. So I don't know. What do you think of that? Because you're kind of more on that side, or at least I don't know if you're on that side. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you definitely have kind of the arguments of why they would.
Yeah. So like you mentioned this before, and we've talked about this, like I feel like I've had to explain whether or not Russia will invade Ukraine like 10 times this week to friends and family, because everyone knows I have an opinion. but I saw this really good YouTube video that included a shit ton of links to the source materials that were in the video. So I had a blast just kind of reading through all of them, and I wanted to basically summarize some of the arguments that they put out in the video. The channel is called TLDR News EU. The video is Putin will never make Ukraine, will never invade Ukraine, three reasons for and against. Maybe we'll link to it. But in summary, here are some reasons why Putin won't invade. So the first one that I thought was pretty compelling was that they would have already done it by now. And kind of the opposite of what you were saying, that, you know, these analysts are saying, which is, you know, the longer he waits, the harder it becomes to invade. You know, the argument can be made that it's already been too long, right? As time goes on, the West is becoming more and more likely to support Ukraine. And since December alone, a lot of countries have toughened their stance against Russia. You know, there have been more sanction ideas against Russia that have been devised. One example is the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project, which is a planned pipeline for gas between Russia and Germany. And initially, the German chancellor, the new German chancellor, Scholz, he didn't want to put the pipeline on the chopping block for new sanctions against Russia because it's, you know, bad economically. But as things have been developing, he's now signaling a willingness to use this as a bargaining chip against Russia. And that's a huge shift. And Western countries are either ramping up or coming around to supporting Ukraine with defensive military equipment. So we talked about, you know, all the money that's flowing in there. You know, the US, the UK, and Denmark by themselves have sent Ukraine about $600 million in arms in the last year. And in September, the US put together a package of about $60 million in weapons, including a shit ton of Javelin anti-tank missiles, which, you know, is like the best tool for combating a Russian ground invasion, because Russia's tank fleet is the largest in the world. So makes sense. Give them anti-tank missiles, you know? And even Germany started helping. They sent, you know, a few thousand helmets, and Germany was originally pushing for a diplomatic solution. So, you know, the argument that they won't invade is that it's already too late. They, you know, it's,
and let's put a pin in that, because I want to talk about that, the German
thing, yeah.
Because that also shows a commitment for them not sending lethal aid.
Yeah, because yeah, that's also and then, exactly.
And you know, the mayor of Kiev came out and he's like, "Oh, next time send us pillows."
Mike
like helmets. Next time send us pillows.
Sends $1 million worth of pillows over.
Yeah, let's send this like $3 million pillows. Let's send them pillows from Mike Lindell.
Yeah, that's what we should do. All right. So the second argument that they won't invade says that Putin hasn't been prepping the Russian people for war. So, you know, war is just unpopular generally for people unless they've been conditioned to want it. So in a country like Russia, who's struggling economically, the last thing you need is an international conflict that you start. People would go nuts. It wouldn't be, it's just not a good look, you know? But if you want to go to war with a country, you typically see the media ratcheting up tension with nonstop coverage. So kind of like how you're seeing right now with Western media doing exactly that. But in Russia, believe it or not, they're not quite as loud about this conflict as we've been. So there was this tweet in the video. It was from a BBC journalist in Moscow who pointed out that just this past Tuesday, January 25th, the primetime news on all the different networks, like all the major networks in Russia, was very different from ours in the West. So I'll read you the tweet. It's from this guy, Francis Scar. On January 26th, he tweeted, make of this what you will. While tensions over Ukraine dominate Western media, on Russia's primetime TV news last night, there were right down the running order. On both Channel 1 and NTV, the story was fourth, and on Rossiya 1, Ukraine wasn't even mentioned until 47 minutes in. I have no way to end it. So, like, this is crazy. You know, personally, I don't have a way to independently verify this because I don't speak Russian, so I don't know. but yeah, if this is true and, you know, their media isn't as loud about this conflict as we are, it's kind of hard to believe that Putin is preparing for an invasion. You know, the news before the Crimean annexation, as an example, or the 2014 invasion of Donbass, it was all over their news networks, nonstop, talking about, you know, protecting Russian people, you know, and like going against fascists and shit. That's what it was about. And they're not even really talking about it. So, you know, if you're not making the media rounds to ratchet up the support for a possible second invasion of Ukraine, that's the same thing as a surprise war, and nobody likes that kind of surprise, and Putin isn't dumb.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, what's interesting is that I wonder if the revolution or riots in Kazakhstan had more coverage compared to what's going on with Ukraine right now.
Yeah, I'm certainly.
I wonder in the context of Russian media, because I mean, when I was, you know, looking into it, Russian media was covering Kazakhstan like crazy. You know, right. That was front page news in Russia.
Because it was an immediate risk. It was an immediate issue, you know?
Well, that's because it's an immediate issue. And then there's actual Russian military assets there that, mm-hmm. you know, there's a violent riot or revolution or whatever. There's a very violent movement that developed in this country. And, you know, you have strategic interest in there. And, you know, I can see why Russian media was all over it.
Right.
But, you know, in 2004, this goes to 2014, you know, obviously there was a lot more on the line. It was right when Russia annexed Crimea, and, you know, there actually is that interest there because, you know, they had that's a real crisis right there. You know, mm-hmm. Where you have your one base that's in your one warm water port is at risk of, you know, your lease is going to be prematurely ended because the new government in Ukraine that you highly suspect, and it's highly likely, came in through an orchestrated coup, is going to take that away from you. You know, that they're ending your lease that you had on a naval base there. And to add to that, that part of the country, Crimea, has been part of Russia for, you know, I mean, they were part of Russia until the 1950s, mm-hmm. and then, you know, until Khrushchev gave it to you, transferred it to Ukraine on Ukraine's 50th birthday. I forget what the occasion was, but he transferred it in commemoration of Ukraine's I think it might have been the 50th anniversary of like Ukraine as a recognized area,
right.
But. All right, I'm rambling a little bit too much. What was the other point?
Okay, so the other point why they're not going to invade would be that unless Putin is like intending to completely take over all of Ukraine, which is extremely unlikely and would be very costly and protracted invasion of just like the Donbass would push the rest of Ukraine farther from Russia and closer to the West and NATO. So he cites a few things. So since 2008, polls show that Ukrainians' favorability to Russia has declined by 50%, with the steepest drops coming after 2014's, invasion and the annexation of Crimea. So what that did was it actually made it harder for pro-Russian politicians to win elections ever since, and results in, a more pro, Western Ukrainian government, right? So they, as a result of those events, are now listing more towards the West. And, if they invade again, they had better just annex the entire damn country, because whatever would be left over from that invasion is going to be so anti-Russian that it would be a nightmare for Russia. And not to mention, it would prompt even more Western support. So it would be kind of a lose-lose situation for Russia if they went in.
Yeah, it seems like it would just be a humongous headache because, I don't think not every single person in Donbass is Russian-speaking, right? There's got to be. Nope. I know it's...
The majority, but they're not everyone. And it's not just the Donbass. It's like the rest of the west of, the west of the Dnieper River, like everybody over there,
Well, anyone I've mentioned before, like McGregor or mm-hmm. Clint Ehrlich or any of the people I've been reading lately have, mm-hmm. they don't think at all that Kiev is under any type of threat. They think right. that it's just the Eastern autonomous regions that are kind right. of under dispute right now and only being held together from not killing each other from Minsk too. Like those are the right. areas that they're, saying that Russia will invade, not actual like the Ukrainian speaking parts.
Right. And if Russia's trying to make it so that the West stops influencing Ukraine because they don't like it on their border, then this is a surefire way to get them to like fail at that mission, because unless they take the whole damn country, they're not like the rest of the country, whatever they don't take or whatever they don't invade, is going to be so pissed, and the West is going to help them. That's just plain. It would be counterintuitive for that, for their goals. Now, the video also puts a couple of reasons why Putin would invade Russia. And the first one's interesting. It's the opposite of the first one. So what you were talking about earlier, that some of the folks that you've been following are really pushing, which is the window of opportunity for Russia to invade is closing. So similar to that first reason why they wouldn't invade, you can argue the inverse, right? So that the invasion is imminent because Putin understands that if he doesn't invade soon, the West will just continue to increase their influence over Ukraine such that their influence, Russia's influence, that is, over Ukraine will be almost zero, which is exactly what Putin was worried about in the first place. So, the idea here is they got to act now, and they should act now, because otherwise it's going to be too late. So that's an interesting argument. It can go both ways, in my opinion. There's reasons for and against it, literally for this just one thing. The second one I think is pretty obvious that a lot of people latch on to, especially in the media, which is the continued troop buildup. We're up to, 125,000 soldiers on the border now, and that keeps growing. And, there's been reports of, Putin moving the Eastern military over to the border with Ukraine, which is thousands of miles away. Like, why would you do that? Why would you move troops thousands of miles across the country just to not use them? So there's that. And it's a fair argument. The Occam's razor argument is like, well, if they're not going to invade, what the hell do they want all those troops on the border for? It's one big ass military exercise, if you ask me, and then the last reason why they will, or why Putin would invade, is that despite the consequences, Putin still invaded Crimea. So, everyone threatened Russia with sanctions if he fucked around in Ukraine back in 2014. And mostly a lot of them followed through with those sanctions, but Putin still did it. He still annexed Crimea and he still invaded Donbass. And that tells us that he cares more about his geopolitical outcomes than he does the repercussions. So the geopolitical outcome for Crimea was, get a warm water port, make sure that we have, access to that sea. So, you know, the negative repercussion was we're going to get hit with a bunch of sanctions. And he weighed the options and he said, fuck it, we're doing it anyway, you know?
Well, you know, I don't really think that's a good comparison, because Crimea is a life or death situation for the legitimacy of his government. Mm-hmm. So it's a way different circumstance. If they lost Crimea, I don't think Putin would be around right now. Like, I think it would just be a disaster for that government. It would totally illegitimize them as a legitimate security force. Like it would illegitimize them as the rightful heirs of the monopoly of violence in Russia. Like mm-hmm. if they were able to lose a historic part of Russia due to what they perceive as an intrusion from the West, I think that would have been the end for them. Like I think that would definitely life or death.
I agree with you fully, but what about the invasion of Donbass? That had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, but Donbass wasn't, it was more of special forces going in there. It wasn't an annexation. It was more supporting.
They still did it. You know, all the Western countries kept telling them, hey, do not invade Ukraine. Do not fuck around in Ukraine. We're going to hit you with sanctions. Crimea, I understand your argument for, but they still invaded Donbass. Even if it was a quick one, and even if it was limited, or as Biden would put it, a minor incursion, they still did it. They don't care. Their geopolitical aims take precedence over the repercussions. Anyway, I think that video is really good, and it highlights a lot of arguments that I don't hear a lot in corporate media. And you know, my take is, and I know I've expressed this before in prior episodes, but I don't think that they will invade. And I still think I'm still there. But that doesn't mean that Russia isn't going to do anything. I think it's incredibly expensive to be moving all those troops around and hardware around for no good reason. So to sum up my opinion, Russia puts troops on the border to act as a tripwire, right? So NATO and others won't fuck around directly if they think it'll start World War III, right? So that's step one. Make sure the West doesn't get involved directly. And step two would be just use that hard power to negotiate some guarantees, you know, with NATO and with the West, right? They've already asked for it very clearly. They already did step two. They said, pull back to the 97 borders. Don't let Ukraine in. And Russia has been, you know, supporting these separatist groups in that eastern Ukrainian region of Donbass. They've been doing it financially and militarily since the last invasion in 2014. And if he fails to get NATO to agree to the terms that they want, then Russia's just going to press that Ukrainian division. He's going to put his finger in that wound even harder, far enough where either, I think, Russia ends up annexing Donbass through a referendum, just like how they did with Crimea, but not through an invasion. Or B, Russia helps the Eastern separatists declare independence from Ukraine to create a new set of buffer states that he can exercise more influence over to fix that problem of Ukraine leaning west. I think the last possible option for me is what Biden calls a minor incursion. You know, I don't think that's off the table for now, but, you know, I still think there are better options that don't involve a straight up war or conflict with Western nations. But in order to do a real invasion, he'd need at least twice as many troops to invade all of Ukraine, right? So the current levels of troops that he have, even though 125,000 is a lot of troops, it's not enough to take all of Ukraine. It just isn't, you know? So, you know, he probably has these troops in there as a backup plan as well to do a quick run through of eastern Ukraine. And, you know, I listened to a podcast about with a guest that was an analyst for Russia, and they were saying that they have a three-phased approach whereby, you know, they first start off just invading the immediate Donbass area, and then they come in from the south, from Ukraine, and kind of bridge the gap and create an effective land bridge for Russia. And then once they've done that, then they can start negotiating again, be like, hey, you know, leave. West, leave. And if that doesn't work out, then they can start sending people in from Belarus, you know, because crossing the Dnieper River is hard, would be very dangerous. So they'd probably come in from the north. Anyway, my point, though, is a quote, minor incursion, as Biden would call it, is not off the table, but there's just other options that are easier and better for Russia than actually committing their troops to fighting on the ground.
And I just want to add something. So Donetsk and Luhansk, they tried to, they already tried to do what Crimea did and vote their way into Russia. But mm-hmm. Putin said no. They said, right. No, we don't, that would be too much right now. So there was already an attempt. For him then.
Yeah.
I still don't think it would be not really useful for them now. I think it would just end up being a humongous headache. And, you know, they've already, I mean, as far as you can trust, like, government, you know, the Russian government is just saying bluntly, like, we have no intention of invading or annexing any territory right now. We just want, like, our security demands met. And that's what I think a lot of this built up is for, is just to, like I've said before, just to, I think we're kind of close to the same page. You know, this build up is to negotiate these things away so they can, you know, they can change the security architecture in Europe right now. And I don't know
if they fail, what their expectations are. I agree with you. I think if they fail negotiations beforehand, you know, probably annexing it would be a headache for them, but it wouldn't necessarily be a headache for them to just destabilize Ukraine by promoting an independence movement, as they have been already, you know? Because then if Luhansk and Donetsk are their own separate entities, they're definitely going to be very heavily aligned to Russia. So it creates a set of buffer states for them. It's not quite as large as the buffer state of all of Ukraine, but it would be politically advantageous for Russia to have, you know, like a destabilized Ukraine.
Well, I think what they rather have is Luhansk and Donetsk part of Ukraine and just be autonomous and hate the government in Kiev.
Right.
I think that's another, like, the most preferable thing.
That's a pretty big plan. Same podcast I was listening to. It's like the federalization of Ukraine. Basically, what they want, what an ideal situation for them would be that every state or region in Ukraine becomes its own sovereign union and is just federalized under all of, quote, Ukraine. But what that does is it breaks up the central power of the Ukrainian government. And a lot of those eastern territories and regions, you know, are gonna immediately be, you know, allowed to deal with Russia in whichever ways that they want. It's kind of like a divide and conquer, if you will, or divide and influence, you know?
Yeah, I think that's where I kind of agree with that analysis the most, that they rather kind of just break in Ukraine internally rather than, you know, officially change borders or anything like that and just have Ukraine be a mess than actually absorb it or even have them be in their own nation states. Because, you know, if they're mainly Russian speaking, then, you know, the obvious kind of conclusion you can make is that they're just going to become part of Russia. Like, why have another Russian nation state? So that's what I think they want. But I want to talk about Zelensky a little bit because, you know, there's this real interesting thing going on with Zelensky and the U.S. really just not on the same page. It's very strange. So lately, well, have you seen this New York Times article? I actually just shared it with you right now, and I don't know, maybe you can read it because you're a better reader than I am. But I highlighted the parts that I wanted to bring up. And basically the story is that Zelensky is getting mad at the U.S. government because he's saying that the U.S. is causing panic in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree with him. But yeah, happy to read it. Just give me 1 second, though, because there's some background noise. All right, so the New York Times article is White House warnings over Russia strain Ukraine-U.S. partnership. So it reads, Ukrainian officials sharply criticized the Biden administration Friday for its ominous warnings of an imminent Russian attack, saying they had needlessly spread alarm, even as new Pentagon assessments said Russia was now positioned to go beyond a limited incursion and invade all of Ukraine. The diverging viewpoints brought into the open the stark disagreement between Ukraine and its key partners over how to assess the threat posed by Russia, which has massed about 130,000 troops on Ukraine's borders in what American officials are calling a grave threat to global peace and stability. The tensions, which have simmered in the background for weeks, have surfaced at a particularly delicate moment as President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia reviews the American response to his demands for addressing Russian security concerns in Eastern Europe. Quote, "They keep supporting this theme, this topic," end quote, President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine said of the repeated warnings by American officials. Quote, "And they make it as acute and burning as possible. In my opinion, this is a mistake," end quote. In his remarks, Mr. Zelensky echoed this sentiment. Quote, "If you look at the satellites, you will see the increase in troops, and you can't assess whether this is a threat of attack or just a simple rotation," end quote, he said. "Our professional people are looking deep into it." Ukrainian officials have also been sharply critical of the decision by the United States, Britain, and others to withdraw non-essential staff from embassies in Kiev, calling it premature. Mr. Zelensky noted that Greece has not even removed diplomats from the consulate near the front lines in the east, where you can hear the cannons firing. "Diplomats," he added, "are the last who should be leaving the ship, and I don't think we have a Titanic here."
Yeah, you know, it's really funny that, I mean, that seems just like complete theater. Like, all right, mm-hmm. Let's just make the diplomats run in fear. Like, you know, there's going to be a Mongol horde coming and chopping people's heads off.
Right. Like, no one's going to attack the diplomats. You know?
Yeah. Like, that's what their job is to do, to be a diplomat and stay in the country and spy on them, right? Like, come on. Like,
the worst that's going to happen to diplomats is that they get expelled. That's it. That's the worst that'll happen to them.
It's like the Russians, you know, they're going to conquer Kiev and then they're going to go and grab U.S. diplomats and, like, hang them in the middle of the town square. Like, that's not, it is
Russians
ridiculous.
Aren't Salafists, and, you know, like, they're not going to go do that.
Take them. They're American diplomat. That's like, yeah, it's just, and you can see what's happening in Ukraine. He's getting, the government there is like, fuck. Like, now there's a panic. And now, or like, you know, we're really not that concerned. And, you know, a lot of our tough talk had to do with taking advantage of different situations and getting more money and getting more arms and all mm-hmm. this. And now it's like backfiring because the U.S. is using us, obviously. And, you know, now we're in a really shitty situation. There was a CNN report, too, that came out on, I think, Wednesday or Thursday of last week. And it basically said that there was a source that the Ukrainian source for CNN came and said the call was bad between Zelensky and Biden. Like, they had a bad call. Like, it was like a unproductive, and, you know, a lot of this sentiment was expressed on this call from this New York Times article. And CNN went back and they kind of like questioned their own source. It was kind of weird. They're like, well, maybe the source is bad, but CNN's own source said that to them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it definitely seems, and Zelensky is coming out publicly and saying this. So, you know, what's going on here? You know, according to the U.S., and we're talking like the United States media, the State Department, Joe Biden, Blinken, Jen Psaki, like the official voices of our government are coming out and saying the invasion is imminent. And, you know, according to Ukraine, there's no reason to panic. So, in fact, according to Ukraine, nothing is happening at all. It's just kind of status quo stuff that's going back to, like, just normal things that happened since 2014. So, you know, Ukrainian officials, they seem a lot closer to what the Russians have been saying. And, you know, the Russians have been saying that, you know, the troops within 100 miles of their border are on routine drills. Well, you know, I think what's happening is that the rhetoric, the panic, is causing a flight in capital to in Ukraine. There's reports on, like, insurance companies not covering like Ukrainian businesses and stuff because of the high risk. Like, it's a high risk environment now, so it makes it just a way more unfriendly place to do any type of business, to put money in it, to provide insurance, provide any type of coverage. So they're getting screwed, and the currency dropped. Their the Ukrainian whatever the hell it's called, was it? Started with an H. I can't even pronounce it. The Ukrainian unit. I was in Europe, and I was in the Czech Republic, and me and my buddies were just calling the currency, because they don't have the euro there. They exchanged something else, and we were just calling it units. Like, hey, can we have a unit, please? Like, just the money units. Their currency crashed to a level where it was since like 2015. So economically, they're suffering right now. And, you know, you have to, you know, remember that Ukraine and Russia, they're trading partners. You know, they were always trading partners. And, you know, they've, before 2014, and before this whole issue with the EU and all this stuff, you know, with the EU and Russia kind of, you know, Ukraine being forced to choose between taking bailout money from Russia and Ukraine and the EU. You know, before that, the relationship was not that bad. Like, of course, there's kind of like historical grievances between, you know, like the Holodomor and stuff like that, and atrocities committed in the Soviet Union. And, you know, you know, Russia didn't, they didn't recognize Ukraine until 1997. And, you know, there was tensions with like leftover nuclear weapons and stuff in Ukraine and stuff like that. And, you know, Russia and the United States were actually on the same page in the 90s about making sure that Ukraine wasn't armed with any nuclear weapons. But, you know, after that happened, their relationship was relatively good. I mean, I'm sure, I'm no expert, I'm sure they had their issues, but, you know, it really, the relationship really didn't turn bad until the 2000s. But yeah, I mean, that's what do you have to say about that? Just, you know, what's going on. Oh yeah. One more thing too, before I forget, I'm going to lose my train of thought. Last week, the Ukrainians and the Russians actually met in Paris to talk about enforcing Minsk II. And Minsk II is the, you know, the agreement right now, the ceasefire in Donbass between Russian separatists and Ukrainian security forces. And it's kind of been holding up for the past 7 years or so. Like, it's loosely been, you know, the fighting is not as intense as it was back in 2014. So, it just goes back to, you know, me really thinking that this is political theater, because in order for the Ukrainians to talk to the Russians in Paris, they had to have had U.S. approval. They had to have like a green light from the United States to actually talk with them. So I'm just thinking like this is just more evidence that this is just, you know, the Biden administration was like, okay, like, you know, we can kind of tail back down a little bit, but we don't want to do it publicly, so why don't we just have the Ukrainians back down?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think you said it best. I don't think that any of what we're hearing about in the media is like true, like sprinkling elements of truth, you know, everywhere. But it seems that you know, Zelensky here was trying to capitalize on this troops build up to gain more support, you know, either to get into NATO or get more military support or, you know, more trading, things like that. And then, you know, the rest of the West took it and ran with it. Because as you pointed out earlier in the show, you know, this enables us to talk about things that were like third wires, right? Third rails, I should say.
So third wires.
Third wires.
I was like, what the hell is a third wire?
Well, you know, the first, the second wire, the third wire. It's the one that you don't clip because it blows up the bomb. No, it's a third rail because things like restructuring the security agreements in Europe, was just not something you talked about. It was political suicide, right? The status quo was the status quo, and it had to remain that way. And if you talked about any other options, then that's bad. You are bad. It's political suicide, you know? So yeah, it gave the US the ability to now start talking about it again, gave the rest of EU the ability to have an open conversation about its relationship with Russia and obviously with Ukraine and border countries. It gave NATO the opportunity to talk about whether or not, you know, adding more member states was, you know, in its, you know, it was good for it, you know, or where should we deploy troops and which countries actually wants to host new troops and who's going to contribute more. And these are all things that you wouldn't talk about in like a straight up peacetime, because they're just, it's not politically expedient to do so. And so, you know, we see Zelensky, basically he opened up Pandora's box on this one, and he's like, yo, chill out. Please relax. It's causing more issues than benefits to me.
Yeah, this is becoming a huge headache. And, you know, he was elected to be kind of a peace candidate, you know? Like, mm-hmm. He wasn't the actual handpicked person to take the job. Like, he beat Poroshenko in a landslide election. But, you know, he was running on, like, you know, not being Poroshenko, who was, you know, who was very anti-Russian, you know? So it's, you know, he definitely adopted like the tough rhetoric, but it's interesting to hear him kind of tail it back. And, you know, he definitely bit off more than he could chew. And I think he's realizing that he's being used. Well, yeah. So here's the thing. I think he probably knew that already, but like now it's like really blatant. Now, the other thing that's really interesting is Germany right now.
Mm-hmm.
So did you hear about Deutschland? You ever watched the Great British Baking Show?
Yeah.
That show is my favorite fucking show in the world. I love it. I watch it. Like, I just started watching it a couple of weeks ago. And the reason why I brought it up is because my favorite character is named Jürgen. And he's from Germany. He's from Germany. He's a German baker. I love this show so much. All right. Back to Germany. So, did you hear about the German naval chief who was forced to resign?
Oh, yeah. Schönbach?
Schönbach. So, I'm going to play the video. I don't know. Did you hear the conversation that he had with the Indian?
Yeah, no, I heard it. But you can play it if you want.
I'm going to play it in the podcast. It's about 2 minutes long, but I think it's valuable to listen to.
Let's play it.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, what is my minister asked me, what do you think what Russia really wants? And I had this on the other side of the street. Is Russia really interested to have a small, tiny strip of Ukraine soil? Integrated in their country? No, this is nonsense. I think Putin is probably putting pressure on it because he can do it. And he knows that he splits the European Union. But what he really wants is respect. He wants, on eye level, he wants respect. And my God, giving someone respect is low cost, even no cost. So if I was asked, it is easy to even give him the respect he really demands and probably also deserves. Russia is an old country. Russia is an important country. Even we, India, Germany, we need Russia. Because we need Russia against China. Probably not from your perspective, but from my perspective, I'm a really radical Roman Catholic. I'm believing in God and I'm believing in Christianity. And there we have Christian country. Even Putin is in Athens, but it doesn't matter. I think having this big country, even if it's not a democracy at our side, as a bilateral partner, giving them a chance with the EU and also the United States of America, having them on eye level, same eye level, it is easy, it's an easy workout. And it keeps us properly, Russia, away from China, because China needs the resources of Russia. And they're willing to give them, because our sanctions sometimes are going the wrong way. But this is foreign policy. This is made by politicians. Of course, we cannot agree on what Russia is doing and teaching now what was. That has had to be addressed. And yes, it's had to also address what is happening in Ukraine. Okay, the Crimea Peninsula is gone. It'll never come back. This is it. This is a fact. And we have to learn that political issues are factual questions and not emotions.
So, all right, you finished watching that?
Yep.
All right, so this guy must be an agent of Putin.
No, dude.
I mean, everything he just said was 100% obvious to anyone who's paying attention to the situation. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he said politically incorrect things. So, you know, you can name a bunch of things that are politically incorrect that he said that are really just taboo. First and foremost, when he said that, you know, Crimea is over with.
Crimea is gone.
Crimea is gone. There's no coming back, man. And then he also said that, you know, we need to respect Putin. Like, just give him the respect. He's earned it. Or, you know, he gained
respect. He probably deserves it.
He probably deserves respect. Two things you could not say if you're a politician in the Western world right now is that Putin deserves respect, and that, you know, Crimea is still gone. So, you know, why are we even pretending that Crimea will go back to Ukraine someday?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why are we even pretending? Like, it's not useful to live in fantasy worlds that Crimea is going to become Ukraine by just pure will. It's just not. And, you know, when politicians say that, when Ukrainian politicians say that, they sound trying not to use that word as much because I get admonished for it.
How about ridiculous? That's another
ridiculous. Different R word. Ridiculous. It's nuts. It's nutty to say that. We're going to take back Crimea.
Good luck.
You and what army? The Nazi army? Yeah. the Nazis? You and the Nazis are going to take it? So it's just like a weird thing that, you know, people need to stop pretending it will happen. And then, you know, you ever hear this guy, the NATO Secretary General, Jens Stoltenberg?
Mm-hmm.
This guy sounds straight up like a Roman consulate dictating terms to the Gauls. Like, he just sounds like an imperial overlord, the way he talks about Russia. He's like, we'll never... He's so hawkish. He's such a blowhard. You know, first of all, your name is Jen and you're a guy. You have a girl's name. Jens. It's like guy's name Ashley. Like Ashley Schaefer. My name's Jen. Jenny. My name's Jen. This thing is, he's Norwegian, so I don't know.
Jens is how it's pronounced.
No, okay, maybe. But I just want to stick with his. He has a girl's name. And, you know, this guy also came out today, just before this podcast, we started recording this. He came out and he made like a public statement how, oh, NATO's not getting involved in an invasion in Ukraine. Like, no, 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 not our NATO. Like, what are you talking about? Not this NATO that we set up. We're not going to get involved in this war. Like, we're not. It's not worth, like, there's a difference between a member of NATO and a, you know, a friend of NATO, and Ukraine's just a friend of NATO, and they're not really NATO. So, you know, sanctions and stuff. Yeah, sure. So it's so much blowhard. It's just so much, just politicians trying to act tough right now. Like, that's what this is. A bunch of, like, you know, people in the state just trying to act tough, but no one's really gonna pop off. It's like guys running, yelling in a bar. at each other, like drunk people yelling in a bar. But what this guy said, to go back to
Schonbach,
it kind of does reflect German policy right now. It's not like that's like out of the blue, you know. It's what he said kind of reflects the German foreign policy with Russia right now. They're less hawkish than the other European countries and way less hawkish than America right now.
Of course, but he got canceled because he said the open secret.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, we were talking about Olaf Scholz earlier, and Olaf Scholz is a new chancellor. He comes from the Social Democratic Party, as opposed to, the CDP that Merkel came from. They are longtime supporters of the Nord Stream pipeline. They're also they've historically been less hawkish on Russia, even during the Cold War. They wanted to have a relationship with Russia in the 70s and the 80s. So, that's where Olaf Scholz comes from, like that political thought. Like, the coalition in Germany right now, they had to create that government with the Green Party as well, and the Green Party is really hawkish. So who knows what will change? But the Olaf Scholz of the Socialist Party is less hawkish, and some other things that are really interesting. We were talking about this before. The aid that Germany has given Ukraine has been non-lethal, so helmets, 4,000 helmets or 3,000 helmets, whatever. And they also blocked lethal aid coming from Estonia.
Mm-hmm.
So,
they also have some propositions of setting up mobile field hospitals. In Ukraine, which I actually personally think that's a good idea. You know, like if you're going to support Ukraine in a way that's not going to give you blowback against Russia, like that's fine. You know,
lethal medical aid.
Yeah, right.
Lethal medical aid.
They're going to force like vaccinations on the Russians. Like, what are they going to do? You know, like. Anyway,
but
it's a good idea.
To go back to the German. If you type in German lethal aid in Google, I did this before we started the show, and it's like the corporate press is just crazy, man. Like, we've been doing this for a while, so you can really just start to recognize patterns.
Mm-hmm.
When there's a narrative that's supposed to be shaped. So if you type in German lethal aid, the first story, the headlines I saw were, first was NPR, Germany baffles some allies with its refusal to supply weapons to Ukraine. The Spectator, 5,000 helmets and Germany's dark history in Ukraine. Reuters, whose side are you on? Russia war threat shakes Ukraine's faith and ties with Germany. NBC. Why Germany might be the West's weak link in the Russia's Ukraine standoff. New York Times. Germany draws mockery for promising 5,000 helmets to help Ukraine defend itself. You know, it's, you start to look at these patterns and like how media, like they just become unison in their messaging about things. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, man, like this is a propaganda campaign. This is a propaganda campaign.
What's preposterous about this is that act like Ukrainians don't need helmets. You know, they're just gonna go into war with just like anti-tank missiles and that's it. Like, they don't need helmets. It's fine.
Hey man, I'm sure that these guys from Right Sector and stuff, they don't all have helmets, right? We want to get our friends in the Azov Battalion and Right Sector helmets, right?
Well, listen, I'm not saying that they should be supporting.
Maybe we won't
it,
put swastikas on their helmets, but no, we want to get them helmets.
Yeah, I'm not making an argument for why they should help, but I am making the argument that is help. That is helpful. 5,000 helmets, field hospitals, other logistical supplies, like that's helpful. And it makes it so that Germany's kind of like not on the wrong side of history here. So, you know, if they start sending Panzer tanks or fucking, you know, fighter jets or some shit like that to Ukraine, and that falls in the hands of a bunch of like neo-Nazis. Like, how's that going to look for Germany? German government supports Nazis in Ukraine. Like, come on, think about that. You know,
yeah, that's not a good look. Hey, we're trying to get away from this story. You know, like, you spent a lot of time in Germany. I have, you know, when I was in Germany, man, these people are, I've just noticed that people there are really sensitive about the Holocaust and World War II.
And for good reason.
For good reasons. But, you know, I've told the story before on this podcast where this German kid, you know, he was young, he was like a 22, 23 years old. He was apologizing to me for World War I and World War II. He's like, "We're so sorry for World War I and World War II." And I was like, "We're just so sorry." And I was like, "Dude, your parents weren't born during World War II, man. Like, you had nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
You had zero to do with World War II or anything. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to apologize."
Right. But it's part of the culture, you know? Like, they definitely have a latent guilt, and they want to, it's weird for us, but it's also, it's kind of endearing in the same way. It shows you that they're trying, you know?
Yeah.
They're trying.
Well, it'd be way more disturbing if they were like, well, you know, there was, you know, only a couple of Jews who died.
yeah, that's way worse. Yeah.
You know, it was you know, only like 200,000 or so. If they were like doing that, it'd be weird. But what they forget the point of. Oh yeah. So another story, when I was in Berlin, I was in a walking tour, and you know, it was a World War II walking tour. And this guy was, we were in a coffee shop, like on our walking tour break. And this guy, this British guy, just yelling at the top of his lung about Nazi Germany and how awful they were. And he's like, "In this building, I'll show you this map. In this building is where they plotted the trains to take Jews to the Holocaust camps and death camps. The German citizens went along with this. The Germans went along with this. It was Hitler's shadow." Just screaming stuff like how the Germans were compliant in the killing. And we're in this, all these German people, young, you know, they're early, you know, 20s and 30s, they're just like on their computer, like doing work, like just having to listen to this all day. Like, just listening to this all day. I'm like, oh man, it's gotta be weird on the psychology of the nation, when your country was like the ultimate bad guy for a number of years, for a decade, like the final boss bad guy. But yeah, it was just, I can see how it's weird. But, you know, on the other hand, with Russia and Germany getting along, that's a good thing in my book, right? Like, you know, when Russia and Germany went to war with each other, it was the worst thing that probably ever happened in the history of the world.
Yeah, one of.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the worst things ever to happen in the history of the world was when Germany invaded Russia and murdered about 20 million people. You know, and then Russia and kind returned back and murdered millions of Germans. So, and then, you know, put the half the state under lockdown for decades and decades, and it was the worst thing, one of the worst things in human history, when Russia and Germany went to war.
We want them just to like play
the nicely. Most horrible war crimes, and just the ugliest thing ever to happen. And you know, it's better that they don't fight and they get along and they trade. It's a good thing.
Yep.
So, do we have time to talk about Yemen at all?
I don't know. I was thinking maybe we can wrap up with the talk about national interest. But
I was thinking about skipping that part and going straight to Yemen, because we're getting longer. Okay.
Yeah, I think we beat this, you know.
Yeah, I think we get the national interest thing. We don't need to. Our audience gets it. We don't need to beat them on the head with. We don't have to be Captain Obvious. All right, but I wanted to use some time to talk about Yemen, because, You know, we pulled an NBC. I think we haven't talked about Yemen in like a year, or MSNBC. We haven't talked about Yemen in like probably a very long time. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the last time we did an episode on Yemen. I think it was probably when we've talked about it, but we haven't done like a full episode. So, you know, part of this is my guilty conscience. So when Biden first took office, he pledged to end U.S. involvement in Yemen. And, you know, for those of you who are not familiar with the war in Yemen, since 2015, the U.S. has actively aided the military intervention of Saudi Arabia and mainly the UAE against the rebel Houthi faction, who is supported by Iran at this point. I mean, you know, there was skepticism how much they were supported by Iran, but at this point they are supported by Iran. And, you know, the U.S. military refueled coalition warplanes and basically provided the Saudi and the UAE forces with intelligence information. And the problem is that, you know, Saudi Arabia is a nasty monarchy, and, you know, their coalition bombs civilian targets, and they orchestrate blockades to create famines. And, you know, we're talking about a war of attrition that's killed, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. And, people who were talking about the war in Yemen were hopeful that Biden was going to reverse some of the policies from the Obama years and the Trump years, because Obama started the war. Donald Trump had the opportunity to end it, but he vetoed it. He vetoed the bill that would end support to Saudi Arabia. And then, you know, the war went on. And then when Biden was elected,
bipartisan bill, by the way. Just want
but
to
yeah,
that
bipartisan
out.
with
Mike Lee,
with
Bernie Sanders,
Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders, and the new bill that's been introduced to end aid is bipartisan again. It's by Rand Paul and Bernie Sanders. But there, so Biden said he was going to change things. You know, he said one of the first speeches he said on foreign policy was that they were going to stop supporting Saudi Arabia. And, you know, really nothing has changed since Biden has been elected president. You know, he recently just pushed a $650 million arms package to Saudi Arabia. Before that, in September, they signed a $500 million helicopter maintenance agreement. So it just seems like it's basically status quo stuff that's going on. And, you know, the reason why Yemen has been in the news, you know, more lately is because the violence has picked up. You know, recently there was a airstrike on a detention facility, and it was filled with migrants. It was a facility to hold migrants. So I'm not really even sure where most of these people were from, but they were just migrants. And around 100 people were killed. And when they went through the fragments of the weapons in the wreckage, it was from Raytheon, of course, obviously, because we armed them. So
it's kind of like that scene in one of those Iron Man movies where I think it was like Wanda, one of the Wanda.
I think
shit like that, where like the bomb doesn't explode and she looks at it and it says like Stark Industries across the side, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like, well, in this case, it exploded. In this case, it exploded and killed a lot of people, and so. You know, what's interesting is that the Raytheon CEO, there was a bunch of defense industry executives, and, you know, we started off with this. I mentioned this in the beginning of the episode that they're basically, there's a article on the Quincy Institute that that pulls these interviews from Raytheon CEO, Lockheed Martin CEO, and another CEO. I forget who, it might have been Boeing. And they were basically just talking about, like, oh, this is a great sales market right now. Like, times are, like, these Muslims hate each other, and nothing's better than when Muslims hate each other.
Right.
When two groups of Muslims hate each other, it works. And so, you know, I'll just take the quote from Greg Hayes. He says, "We're seeing, I would say, opportunities for international sales. We just have to look to last week where we saw the drone attack in the UAE which have attacked some of their other facilities. And of course, the tensions in Eastern Europe, the tensions in the South China Sea, all of those things are putting pressure on some of the defense spending over there. So I fully expect we're going to see some benefit from it. Let's just play a little bit of Occam's razor. I think most of this is just hoopla. A lot of this hoopla is just money.
Follow the money.
People are making money off these wars, so they're going
to
happen.
It's just ugly,
or at least
to
the tensions.
Hear out loud. It's so ugly to hear out loud.
They'll tell you, hey, this is a great opportunity for us. It was like when Trump was president. A lot of people didn't like him because I think he was so blunt about a lot of the ugly things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he was, when he was talking about the war in Yemen, he basically made the case. He was like, what do you mean we're not going to sell them arms? We're making the biggest arms deal in history. Muslims, right. Muslims, you know, there's two types of Muslims. There's a Sunni Muslim and there's a Shia Muslim, and apparently they're at war. We need to make some money off this. Like, obviously I'm highly paraphrasing what he said, but it was basically that kind of theme.
Yeah.
But, you know, he just kind of put a face on it. And I think that's one of the reasons why the corporate press and hated him so much. Because he was just kind of like an ugly face to an ugly system. You know, you want like a nice face to that. But, yeah, I just wanted to talk about that before we ended that episode. I think it kind of wraps it up a little bit.
I mean, it's obviously going to cause some issues, you know.
But yeah,
first of all, I think this is like something that you're right. I kind of do feel bad now. I went and looked it up and we haven't talked about Yemen officially in any, you know, Yemen specific episode for like, I think since before the pandemic. So maybe we can blame that. it's a supply chain issues on Yemen. No dude, but like a lot of the reasons why we, you know, talked about Yemen is just because it's probably one of the ugliest conflicts. One of the most devastating conflicts, and no one talks about it. And the fact that we, I obviously mean the United States military and our government, is supporting what feels like the wrong side. Or why are we involved in the first place, you know? And the fact that we're just not cutting it off, like I think this is the first time when I heard you say something exceptionally negative about the Trump administration was when he vetoed that bill. I agree. I thought it was devastating. I thought it was probably the worst thing Trump ever did, because so many people are dying from this conflict, both from the actual war and the famine that comes around with it. It's just terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And what's happening is that... Sorry, hold on. What's happening is that it's creating new enemies for us, right? And you pointed it out in the beginning of this segment. You know, initially, Iran was like kind of helping the Houthis a little bit in Yemen, and now it's like pretty much they're helping them out. And you know, one article that we just got today from one of our Patreon members is talking about a joint military exercise between Iran, China, and Russia. And how, you know, the Iranian general or commander was saying that, you know, this proves that, you know, the Western, you know, hegemony is broken, and that, you know, when states, you know, that don't fit into the fold, so to speak, the Western fold, decide to work together, that they can accomplish great things. And, you know, to relate this back to Russia, like it seems like we're creating a bipolar world between the West or NATO and all of the other countries, right? I mean, we see that with how we, with Yemen, you know, right now Iran is definitely backing Yemen. And if Iran is also doing military drills with both Russia and China, and Russia and China are doing drills, and Russia's fucking around in Ukraine, and China's doing some shit, you know, and I don't know, maybe Venezuela joins, like we said earlier in the show, you know, like we can start seeing an axis. I think there was an actual word that he used, to describe the axis. If I can find it, I'll say it. But you know what I'm saying? I think there's going to be some blowback here for our continued support in this shitty, terrible, disgusting conflict.
Well, it's like, you know, now you have a combination of the Tang Dynasty, the Persian Empire, and Tsar is Russia, or the Soviet Union. Let's just say the most powerful military forms of all of them. Now they're all combined into one mega empire. I mean, I'm being super hyperbolic right there. That's not actually the case at all. But you know, you can, if you see the world in black and white, you can kind of put it like that, like the Orientals versus the rest of the world. Now, you know, the blowback that I'm also concerned about is just the Arabian Peninsula is full of Al Qaeda people. Like, when does that just like come back to bite you in the ass? Like, come on, and like, there has to be. I mean, I pray that there's not, but there has to be fostering more extremism in there, in that part of the world. These continued terror wars, and now, I mean, now it's just support. Now it's just like going back and forth. Like, are we going to fight the terror war against Al Qaeda, or are we going to attack? We're going to fight the Houthis. Which one? I guess it depends on what Saudi Arabia wants at that time period. But yeah, that's just kind of a morbid way to end the episode, but thought we should talk about it.
Yeah, we're paying attention. So, all
right, should we end this thing?
Yeah, man.
All right, thanks everyone for listening to another episode of Bro History. If you want to support the show, rate and review the podcast. You can rate us on Apple. You can also rate us on Spotify now, so do that. Before we remove ourselves from Spotify, and I'm joking, we're not going to do that. I was, you know, the joke I was making, but so yeah, support us on those platforms by rating us, and then if you want to support us more, go to our Patreon page where you get access to our Slack account, and our Slack account is a real fun way to stay in contact with us and our community that we built. We have a great one where, you know, we're continuing to discuss these stuff, this stuff on a daily basis. So join us there. Yeah, we'll be back next week with our follow-up episode to the Korean War.
Peace.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.